Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac-Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. First of all, spring training games are underway. All teams have begun their exhibition games, which means you can now watch live baseball every day for the next several weeks, which is obviously awesome. Also, there's actual baseball news. This was one of the busiest weeks of the offseason, and here are some key highlights. J.D. Martinez signs with the Red Sox, though it's still pending a physical, so they haven't really announced that one yet. The Tigers and Francisco Liriano agreed on a deal. As a result of being designated for assignment last week, Corey Dickerson is being traded to the Pirates. More things involving the Rays. Carlos Gomez signs with Tampa. And then, again, the Rays. There was a three-team trade involving Tampa Bay, the Diamondbacks, and the Yankees, sending Brandon Drury from Arizona to New York and Steven Souza from Tampa to Arizona. And then there's also kind of disappointing news for some baseball fans. Top Rays pitching prospect Brent Honeywell was diagnosed with a torn UCL, and Tommy John surgery has been recommended for him. And then the Astros pitching prospect Forrest Whitley was suspended for 50 games this season for a substance of abuse. According to Chuck Mike Tanak of KABB Fox San Antonio, Whitley was given an unknown stimulant by a friend in order to be able to drive after attending an out-of-state college baseball game. So, of all the stuff that happened this week, is there anything in particular we have burning thoughts on?
I just want J.D. Martinez to be signed.
I do, too, because my fear is that if this somehow goes awry, the D-backs are going to just be like, okay, we're going to swoop in now, and then he will haunt my dreams for years to come. So I really want the Red Sox to get him.
Apparently, John Heyman tweeted this morning that it's not an injury holdup, that both sides are just, like, combing through the contract to get that correct. I don't know that I've ever seen it take this long to do that, which is concerning, potentially. But
it's,
I mean,
that kind of off-season, though.
Yeah, exactly. But I just want to see him in a Red Sox uniform.
Yeah, he seems like a really natural fit there, and it would be ridiculous if they can't manage to get this done, because, come on, like, get it together, guys.
Like, look at what the Yankees did, and what have you done? Basically nothing until this contract is signed, so just get it together, you know, agree to whatever he wants in this stupid contract, and let's all move on.
At least Mookie Betts got paid. I will give the Red Sox that.
I mean, but that wasn't their doing.
Yeah. Oh, arbitration.
Such a good time.
It's a good system, guys. It works well.
It's so great. No conflicts. No people being underpaid. It's fantastic.
Well, yeah, it's nice that games are happening. After this, I get to go watch Clayton Kershaw pitch for like an inning, so that's obviously like all that I need in life.
Yeah, no, it's great. And you're going to get a lot of people diagnosing every single pitch, which is always super fun and the best part of spring training.
Oh yeah, people forgetting. It's like, oh yeah, it takes athletes a while to, you know, get back into form. And if they, you know, aren't throwing strikes or giving up home runs, like, that is exactly what they're going to do for the entire season, too.
Yeah, like, I, you know, for those who don't know or weren't anywhere near the internet yesterday, Shohei Ohtani made his...
Who?
I guess debut of sorts in an Angels uniform, and it wasn't necessarily the best outing, and I think people were already quick to worry, like, oh my god, this is how Ohtani's going to pitch the rest of the season. No, it's not. It's not. This is his first spring training outing. Things will change. he shows flashes of brilliance because, holy crap, those pitches were things of beauty. So, yeah, I think everyone's just getting on the panic train, like, well before people should actually be panicking. It's only been, like, 2 days of exhibition games.
Yeah, but isn't that just baseball fans for you? I mean, I feel like we've talked about this a lot, but I feel like baseball fans as a whole they're just, like, by nature a pessimistic bunch. They, like, want to find the worst in everything, and they feel like they need to, like, prepare for the worst, I guess, because more often than not, like, the season ends in heartbreak. So you might as well expect one of the biggest prospects in recent MLB history to be a bust after, you know, one outing in spring.
Yeah. And also,
go ahead.
Speaking of big prospects, Tim Tebow twisted his ankle this morning, stepping on a sprinkler in the outfield.
Oh, dear.
I shouldn't be laughing, but that also is very baseball.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, if you're going to tell me Tim Tebow got hurt, I feel like that's exactly how I would expect it to happen.
Yep.
Like, something just really dumb like that. Not, you know, oh, yeah, he, like, tore something or whatever running the bases. Like, no, he stepped on a sprinkler.
Right, and I think it's so perfect him coming from football, where they have, like, legitimate impact injuries. And this is, like, essentially one of the most baseball-esque injuries that could have possibly happened to him.
Yeah, very much so. Let's see what else has happened. There was, I don't know, it's been kind of fun to see some of the more touted prospects getting reps, like Fernando Tatis Jr. of the Padres hit a home run. And, you know, I don't know. Have I said this on the podcast that I'm working for MLB.com now? And I don't know. Maybe I have, maybe I haven't. I am. Hi guys. And it was just kind of fun to see, like, you know, that day I was working on a Padres game and it was like, oh, well, as soon as that happened, like the entire focus of the coverage was the Fernando Tatis Jr. home run. And it's like, you know, fans, especially of franchises that probably aren't going to be competing this year, like they need like any little glimmer of hope that they can get. And so to see like someone who is supposedly going to be the future face of the franchise doing well early on, that is something that's really exciting for a lot of people. And it's no wonder that that's what, you know, I'm choosing to focus on in coverage.
Yeah. And Tatis Jr. is just incredible to watch. So I have a feeling that Padres fans things are going to start looking up for them in the next 5 years.
Yeah, I'm a little worried about that, I won't lie. I mean, I know that the Dodgers are in good shape as well, but like, I don't know. I was enjoying that thing where the NL West was just terrible. And now it's like, oh, well, we have like a couple of like legitimate contenders now. And then in a couple years, like it could be like the entire division's actually really competitive. So we'll see.
Yeah. A couple of friends and I were talking the other day and one of them asked, what's the best and worst case scenario for your favorite team this season? And the only thing I could answer was, oh, my best case scenario for the Giants is that hopefully none of them get into a weird accident like running over a jackalope on a desert Sahara and missing the rest of the season. So I think my expectations for the Giants are very low, despite the fact that they have, you know, acquired a lot of good players. I am still scarred by Madison Bumgarner's injury, which was
I don't think I'm ever going to be over that, but like in a different way than you are never going to be over it.
I mean, I think the only way I would have been okay with it if it was a very freak injury, because we've had a lot of those as Giants fans, like Jeremy Affeldt's existence. First with a frozen hamburger, then straining his back while picking up a child. And then there was Matt Cain slicing his hand because he was trying to cut a sandwich for his daughter. Yeah, it's been a decade full of weird injuries for the Giants. So Madison Bumgarner seems a little bit more normal compared to, oh, I'm cutting a frozen hamburger patty and I'm going to slice my hand open.
That's the only time anyone has ever called Madison Bumgarner normal.
This is extremely true, though this is the same man who may or may not have made up the fact that he once dated someone whose name is also Madison Bumgarner. So yeah, I have very low hopes for the Giants, and I think really if they stay healthy and not put together with duct tape, I'm calling that a victory. But this is the NL West, and considering that three National League postseason teams last year, you know, including the wild card, were NL West teams, who knows? Because I'm pretty sure everyone's going to start talking about how it's an even year again if the Giants start winning games, and people are just going to talk about how the NL West is stacked because you've got the Rockies opening up their window of contention, you've got the Diamondbacks doing pretty dang well, and then you've got the Dodgers who are the Dodgers and are just good. So
meanwhile,
I was just going to say, I suggest stocking up on a lot of antacids for NL West fans.
Yeah, good times.
Should be a fun season for you people. Meanwhile, I'm pretty sure that the only games the Rays are going to win are going to be against divisional opponents, because that's just such an AL East thing to have happen. But like, what are they doing, you know? And especially now, I feel so bad. I feel bad for Brent Honeywell, because that's such a tough thing to have happen, particularly when it seems like his organization needs him the most. Although, who knows, if they would have traded him or traded anyone that remotely displayed any sort of talent whatsoever at this point.
Yeah, it's always really disappointing to hear that. Well, it's disappointing to hear that anyone needs surgery that is going to keep them out for a long time, but there's a sort of added layer of disappointment when it's someone who is, you know, a highly touted talent. And so, yeah, it's disappointing, you know, he may end up being fine in the long run, you know, it may just end up that his career is postponed a little bit, and you know, eventually he comes back and he's, you know, as good as he ever was going to be. But yeah, it just seems like everything, I don't know, it just seems like this is a really bad time to be a Rays fan. Like, you know, one of the few things you had to look forward to has just been stripped away from you, and yeah, that's not a good situation.
And it's not like they can, you know, flip over and start following the Marlins instead, because they're in an even worse position.
Man, did you see, I assume you guys saw Nick Stellini wrote about, you know, obviously jokingly about like combining the Rays and Marlins franchises into one like Super Florida team, and how mad, I don't know if Marlins fans got mad, but I saw Rays fans getting really mad.
Yeah. I feel like Marlins fans have just kind of accepted the state that they're in, and they're as angry with the team as everybody else. Whereas I think Rays fans might be more in shock at the trajectory of their team. And so I think in general, they're a little more defensive still of their team's moves. And, you know, they don't seem to be liking the fact that people are calling the Rays organization out.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, because, you know, obviously this is anecdotal, but I just feel like from the response I've seen, like, Marlins fans are like, yeah, we're just as mad about the situation as anyone else is, and we're going to, you know, be really critical of, you know, Jeter and everyone involved. And maybe it's easier to do when it's a new ownership group versus, you know, people that have been around for a while. And maybe it's because it's still too this, like, new direction that the Rays are going in. Maybe it's because it's still so new and they're still, like, adjusting to it that Rays fans, like, are in, like, a state of denial, I guess, that, you know, this is happening or that it's actually as bad as it is. And, yeah, I don't think I saw any articles really defending what the Marlins were doing, like, from Marlins blogs and stuff, whereas I've seen some of that from, like, you know, Rays fan media. And it's just, I don't know, it's just interesting to compare the two, because, you know, they're obviously not parallel situations, but there's a decent number of similarities. And I don't know, it's again anecdotal, but it's been interesting to notice, like, the differences in reactions between the two fan bases.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like Marlins fans also have a sense of humor about things. Whereas for Rays fans, and this is not a knock on Rays fans because I completely understand that this is a terrible time to be a Rays fan. But at the same time, it's kind of like, at least look on the bright side of things, which is, okay, I actually don't have anything. Wow. Okay, my point just completely went out the window.
We just lost all of our Rays fans listeners.
I'm sorry, Rays fans. I'm really sorry. You have Matt Duffy, my favorite Giants player who really didn't, like, exceed expectations after Rookie of the Year voting, and
that, there you go, that's your note of optimism for them. You have Matt Duffy. Oh,
good job.
Only spring training and we're already in top form.
Oh yeah.
This bodes well for the rest of the season for both us and Rays fans.
Yeah, who's gonna come out of the season in better shape, us or Rays fans?
We'll have to set up a Twitter poll and have people vote.
I'm gonna say Denard Span hits 20 homers though, because I am very good with predictions, as we mentioned last week.
He's going to hit, like, negative 20 home runs somehow, just to...
Yeah, they're going to, like, retroactively take home runs away from him from earlier seasons in his career.
Oh, baseball. How I've missed it.
Yeah.
So glad it's back.
I know. Just, like, having games every single day again. Oh, it's amazing. Although I haven't watched any yet, but, I mean... It's great to know that I have the option.
We're now joined by a friend of the podcast and Hardball Times, Vice Sports, Baseball Prospectus, and BP Toronto contributor Rachel McDaniel to discuss their article published this week on the site called Baseball as a Business, a Historical Perspective. Rachel, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I'm glad to be here again.
We are very glad to have you again. So we'll start off. For just those who have not had an opportunity yet to read your article, I don't know what they've been doing with their time, but they should rectify that. Could you just give us a quick overview of what your article is about?
My article is about the feeling that I've been seeing expressed a lot lately with the way this offseason has unfolded about, okay, we love baseball. We hate the way baseball is run. Professional baseball is run by this, like, soulless, greedy, capitalist machine that we want nothing to do with anymore. And then as I was doing research for something else, as happens, I got completely distracted, and I stumbled across this article from 1870, which was expressing much the same sentiment. And so I decided to go back through the archival history of people talking about baseball and see just what kinds of sentiments I could find expressed towards the conflict between we love the sport and we hate the business.
I think that all of us here can relate to the sentiment of working on research for one thing and then getting completely sidetracked by something else that comes up. And, you know, that's often what leads to some of the more interesting things that we write about, just, you know, things that we discover by pure happenstance. So when you began the task of looking back through history at the fans' relationship to baseball as a business, did you have any idea of what your findings might be? You know, maybe not, because this was something that, again, you kind of came upon randomly. And was there anything that you were surprised to not see?
I figured that people would have kind of the same sentiment. I was surprised by just like how heightened it was. In the three pieces that I chose to write about in the piece, there was some like really, really heightened language. People were very, very angry. People were talking about, in the one from 1870, people were talking about like players getting maimed constantly on the field. Like baseball is a terrible risk to everyone's health, like a public menace, really. And then in the last piece from 1927 about the Rogers Hornsby trade, there was just some really delightful, super metaphorical language used to describe this person's disgust with the way the trade went down. So that was something that surprised me. I didn't expect people to like go all in like that, but it was a pleasant surprise. It made for some really fun stuff to write about.
Yeah, I can only imagine, especially having been an English student who studied like the early 20th century and its language a lot. There are some very colorful things said about many things. But baseball for decades has been viewed here as a uniquely American sport. How much of this debate about its business elements and professionalization do you think accounts for this labeling of it as American?
Well, obviously, like, we know now in our era that it would be just really myopic and false to say that baseball exists, like, within the American circle, like it's especially American in some way. But I do think that this particular debate, I can't speak for the way that this debate might play out in, say, Japan or Korea, because I don't have the level of knowledge about those markets. But within this context, I think that it is a specifically American phenomenon, like this kind of discussion, because baseball's professionalism kind of grew and expanded as American capitalism was growing and expanding in parallel. So, yeah, I do think that's something that was probably going on within the cultural kind of milieu, and just kind of extended to baseball, as many things do. Many societal conversations end up creeping into baseball as well.
Yeah, something else that I think ties into this is the whole branding of baseball as a national pastime. And that's actually an interesting subject in and of itself. It was kind of an early proto PR campaign that was essentially the doing of A.G. Spalding to try and promote his National League. There's a couple of really interesting articles out there about this that I won't attempt to summarize too much, but I do think that, you know, that is also a substantial part of the branding of baseball as American. It's like, oh yes, this is like such an American thing and it's our national pastime and, you know, you should partake in this sport because it's, you know, a patriotic thing to do.
Yeah, and that's something that comes up a lot in the debate in the pieces that I talk about, because there's this conflict between people buying into that whole mythos of baseball as America's sport, as representative of all that is great about America, and saying, okay, adding this business dimension is corrupting the pure morality that we have loved to see within this game. especially in the earlier, like the earlier pieces that were written closer to when baseball was mostly amateur, like written closer to the actual crystallization of professional baseball. So yeah, and that's like, that's a conflict within the American soul, I guess, as well, between knowledge of the reality of like America and this ideal of the American dream and of American values being representative of something higher. And it ends up playing out in baseball again. So that's another one of the reasons why baseball is so great. You have all these like moral debates playing out within the framework of the theater of the sport. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's something that definitely makes it more American, in the sense that both the country and baseball really kind of have these unique foundings, or at least people kind of have this idea of both of them as having those. And just so much of both is trying to recapture the spirit of these foundings. And then that creates a lot of debate for how, baseball should be utilized, whether changes in baseball are positive or negative, and whether there is this kind of American spirit in baseball that needs to be preserved.
Yeah, people always talking about like the spirit of the game, and they talk about it in that same voice that they talk about the American dream. It's some like ideal that exists well in the past, so such that nobody can remember it, and it's something that's constantly under threat, because of I don't know, corporate greed, whether because of changes to the rules of baseball, whether because players are doing something that people don't like. And that's, they really just run in parallel to each other.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me also of how a lot of people cry for, you know, the spirit of baseball being as it was over 100 years ago. But also, you know, over 100 years ago, there were not as many technological advancements, and also there was no integration, and there's just so many facets to it that I don't think it will ever actually be the same as it was, you know, in the early 20th century, late 19th century. But you know, I think the big debate is, how do we maintain the spirit of the game through progress?
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I think that's something that a lot of people haven't really considered. And I think, you know, you bring up a good point with how business ties into it, because as the 20th century, you know, got entrenched more and more into the capitalistic society, you know, it's kind of like, how do we have this balance of, you know, America as it is right now and baseball as it is right now, and trying to coexist with baseball as a sport, as an escape, as a means to escape reality.
Yeah, and that's part of what I was trying to tap into in my piece, is just showing that baseball in the early 20th century, or even back to 1870, which was really not that far removed from the invention of the sport, is that there was never a point where everybody was like, okay, like we've captured the spirit of baseball. Baseball is like good right now. There's always been this raging debate. There's always been people saying we need to recapture the spirit of baseball. There's just never been the idealized point that people look back to. Like, there were no good old days, basically. The spirit of baseball, like, I'm about to say something really cheesy. The spirit of baseball pretty much exists only in our hearts and minds. It is not a product of any reality reflected by professional or amateur baseball ever at any point.
Yeah, I think just in general, a lot of the same themes that we talk about in commentary on baseball today are just themes that have been running throughout the history of the sport. And I think that those things don't change because people don't change that much. You know, as much as we like to think that we're, you know, different and more advanced than our forefathers, like, in a lot of ways, human nature remains very much the same. And, you know, we see that reflected in baseball and the way that we talk about baseball as well.
Yeah, totally. But again, I think that's something that's really cool. I like having this connection to these people who are watching a sport that wasn't even like quite the same. This, like, a lot of the pieces I read were still from the dead ball era, or just from the very beginnings of professional baseball. It's not nearly as big as it is now. It's not as fast, but we still have these same problems watching it, and we still have this same feeling of like, this is something greater that needs to be protected.
Yeah, for sure.
As you mentioned earlier in the discussion and in your piece, a lot of the discussion focused on, the morality of baseball. Do you see any way in which baseball in its current incarnation, which is so similar to how people viewed it in the 1870s and early 1900s, can be a moral force in the country and the world, as people writing the column seem to think that it should be?
I don't think we should be taking baseball and trying to, like, as it was used. Total side note, I read a really interesting thing about baseball in the Cold War and people basically saying that we should use baseball as anti-communist propaganda, like as a way of thwarting communism. It was really wild. But
it's like literally changing the name of a team because you don't want to be too associated with
absolutely
political ideology. That's the Reds becoming the Red Legs, if anyone missed that, but I'm sure no one did.
Yeah, so I don't think it's wise or even ethical to try to use the sport itself to enforce morality. But I think the sport can, and the scene of professional baseball, and like what I described as the theater of it, can be a really, it can be a good way to have people connect with social issues in a way that they might not have before if they're not otherwise inclined to be socially minded. Because again, a lot of the social tensions, a lot of what's on the mind of America in any given century or any given like moment ends up showing up in baseball. And so I think those things are worth pointing out and worth discussing as they are happening within the sport. And it's worth discussing how they connect to what is going on in society as a whole. Like, I don't think that's something that should be ignored in favor of, you know, the spirit of the game, the purity of the game, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a debate that's just going to keep going on until the end of time. And I think every time it's just going to be a worthwhile debate because, you know, everyone's opinions are different, but it's just so fascinating to talk about in any regard.
Yeah, and that's why I wrote about it. You can go read it right now. Have a great time.
please read Rachel's work, all of it, if you haven't already. Rachel is amazing. And also follow them on Twitter at @rumhamlet. Rachel, thank you for an interesting discussion as always, and we love having you on.
Thank you, guys. I love being here.
And now, this week's article summaries. Mary?
Thanks, Jen. So on Monday, we had Bad Beats, Baseball's Worst Losses, NL Edition, by Shane Tortolotti. What makes a loss particularly difficult to handle? The size of the lead given up, the lateness of the lead given up, and, of course, the players responsible for the blown lead. With this general criteria in mind, Shane gives us a list of the worst loss for each NL team. While some may be able to guess their team's worst loss, others might be surprised by Shane's pick. Regardless, we could all use a reminder of misery to undercut the feelings of jubilation over the return of baseball, so head on over and read Shane's article. On Tuesday, we had The Physics of the Rarefied Air of Spring Training by David Kagan. As the title suggests, David provides us with all the information we need to understand the physics of the ball during spring training games in Arizona and Florida. The piece begins by noting that the two places have similar climates this time of year, save for the increased humidity in Florida and the elevation in Phoenix, of course. Last season, Phoenix teams hit roughly 15% more home runs per at-bat than Florida teams, which is about 10% higher than it should be. Why is this the case? David provides an interesting answer that centers on pitching.
All right. Then on Wednesday, we had How Should the Giants Handle Barry Bonds' Number Retirement by Brittany De La Cotard. Here, Brittany discusses the complicated nature of recognizing Barry Bonds' achievements, not just because of his steroid use, but because of his history of domestic violence. Essentially, Brittany calls for us to talk about baseball players not just in terms of their numbers, but as full human beings, taking care not to erase the suffering any victims experienced. We can certainly recognize someone's contributions to the game without in turn treating them like perfect, infallible beings. Then Thursday, we have Defining a Baseball Bust by Timothy Malcolm. In the wake of former number one draft pick Mark Appel's retirement, Timothy examines what it means to be a quote-unquote bust. He shares the stories of other ballplayers whose careers didn't pan out the way they were expected to and what they ended up doing once they left the game. For some, it's a real struggle. For others, they managed to make it work. No two stories are exactly the same. Timothy's article is a reminder of the human lives behind the public faces of big-name prospects and that, believe it or not, there can be life beyond baseball, provided one has certain resources available to them. And then Friday, we had Baseball as a Business, a Historical Perspective by Rachel McDaniel, which we have already discussed with the author on here. So that takes care of that.
For next week, we have Brittany De La Cotard celebrating the anniversary of the first and only game called by an all-female umpiring crew. Eric Robinson explores some of spring training's forgotten locales. Dave Jordan recalls a Mike Norris-Jesse Jefferson duel with a hidden significance. Andrew, I am going to butcher this, and I am so, so sorry. Domenigiani presents research on the physics of and physics and timing of the infield bounce throw, and more. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen McRamos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe, and be sure to tune in next week for another episode.